Hey, this is Casey Roush, and you're listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio. My name is Keith Brownhill. Today, host Peter Hoffman of the National Lawyers Guild talks with UMKC law professor Alan Rostam, a former senior staff attorney at the Brady Center to Prevent Gun Violence. Mr. Rostam will tell us about the economics of the gun industry itself and its subsidization through various tax credits by direct spending and legal forbearance. This is the first of two shows addressing aspects of the gun debate that you won't hear on mainstream news. Now let's go to Alan and Peter.
Good morning. You are listening to the Jaws of Justice Radio on KKFI 90.1 FM, Kansas City Community Radio. Since the Sandy Hook massacre took place over 2 months ago, a number of politicians and advocates have introduced various proposals to help reduce or eliminate violent gun crime in the United States. At the same time, gun manufacturers and sellers receive several governmental benefits and protections at local, state, and federal levels. Today is part one of a series that examines gun corporatism. To talk about the history of product liability lawsuits against gun manufacturers is Alan Rostran. He is a professor of law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Before joining the faculty there, he worked in Washington, D.C. as a senior staff attorney at the Brady Center to Prevent Gun Violence. He was part of nationwide litigation efforts that included lawsuits brought against gun manufacturers by several dozen major cities and counties. Professor Rostran, can you give our listeners a little background on the history of gun control? I know back in the 1990s, the handgun debate was a big issue. Was that really the start of this product liability litigation? Is that where it got off the ground?
Yeah, that's right. And even somewhat earlier than that, there were first lawsuits relating to guns in the going back to the 80s. A lot of them were focused especially on handguns, and a lot of the lawyers that brought them had very aggressive legal theories, which would essentially have made manufacturers of handguns liable for any sort of shooting with that product. In other words, claiming that a handgun is a product that's ultra hazardous, as you might say in tort law, or the risk is greater than the utility of the product, and that makes it defective. So they were very ambitious theories that would have covered, you know, almost any criminal use of a gun, and they were, in those cases in the 80s, were generally unsuccessful. There was, I think, sort of one that was successful in Maryland. The court agreed that you could have liability for a Saturday night special sort of cheap, low-quality handgun, but that case then got overruled by the Maryland legislature. So there really wasn't any success. Then you had sort of a second wave in the 90s, right around the time that I started working on the issue toward the end of the 90s. And the idea was, let's not be so sweeping in our attempt to impose legal liability for this. Let's make a more narrow, targeted argument, which is to say, guns, it's not necessarily that selling guns creates liability on you, but if you do it in an unnecessarily dangerous way, then it does. So it was focused on arguing that there are ways that guns could be designed to be more safely. So focusing on the idea that they should come with some kind of locking mechanism in them or other safety features. And then also on the distribution side, the argument would be, you know, just selling a gun, if you sell it the proper way, then you shouldn't be responsible for what happens with it. But if you sell it in a negligent, unnecessarily, or unreasonably dangerous way, then you could have liability for that. So, for example, if you're a manufacturer who is selling through dealers that you have a lot of reason to believe are not careful and or even perhaps corrupt and deliberately selling guns to people who are supposed to be prohibited from having them, like convicted felons and that sort of thing, then that's negligent, and so you should be doing a better job of overseeing the distribution of your product, and you could be held liable for that.
So with this idea of imposing liability on the seller or the manufacturer, what's an analogy there? Is it kind of like a bar overserving a patron or something like that?
Yeah, I think you could imagine a situation with alcohol. You know, you're not generally courts don't impose liability on a seller of alcohol for someone who, Budweiser or whatever, Anheuser-Busch, they're not responsible if somebody has a drunk driving accident. But on the other hand, a lot of states do have sort of a dram shop liability idea that if you oversell to somebody when you know they're intoxicated or if you don't ask for identification and they're underage, you can be responsible for that. There was just another analogy kind of inspired by the gun lawsuits. There was a lawsuit filed in Arkansas a couple years ago relating to the product of like cold medicines, over-the-counter cold medicines, which people buy in large quantities and then they use it to extract an ingredient that they then use to make in the manufacture of methamphetamine. And there was a lawsuit brought against, it wasn't successful ultimately, but there was a lawsuit brought by a bunch of counties down there who said that the manufacturers of these over-the-counter cold medicines know that lots of the product is being used for that, and they could be more careful. They could implement ways to either design the product to make it so it couldn't be used for that, or to distribute the product more carefully to oversee the way that pharmacies are selling it, and that they were instead choosing to sort of turn a blind eye to it because they knew that, frankly, they made a lot of money off it. So that was kind of an example of another product that has the same sort of negligent distribution theory to it.
So were these lawsuits primarily brought by individuals or cities or counties, or how did they work?
Yeah, there were a lot of lawsuits, you know, again, at that time that I was working on it. There were sort of fell into two categories. There were what I would have called the individual lawsuits, meaning lawsuits brought by either a person who was a victim of a shooting or family members, you know, if the person was killed in the shooting. So there were some very some of the high-profile shootings of that era generated lawsuits. For example, there was a lawsuit about the there were the two snipers who sort of terrorized the Washington, D.C. area for a while in the early part of the 2000 decade. And that generated a lawsuit about the way the dealer had sold that gun. So other shootings like that, sometimes accidental shootings, sometimes intentional criminal shootings. So a lot of lawsuits like that. Some are just sort of a lawsuit about one person. Others were sort of like a larger, almost a class action type of case. And then there were the what we call the municipal lawsuits, which were essentially cities and counties. And there were about 30 to 35 cities and counties all over the country, from, you know, California to Boston to Miami, that filed a variety of lawsuits against gun manufacturers, some gun dealers, and also against the gun industry trade associations. There's, you know, the NRA is really an organization of gun owners, and they weren't sued in these lawsuits, but there are associations for the gun manufacturers, and they were defendants in a lot of the lawsuits.
This type of litigation then was huge. It seemed like a really big thing. But can you talk a little bit about the fate of this litigation and why it kind of dropped off?
You know, the lawsuits had mixed results, I would say, and it kind of depends on what you consider the objectives of them. Some of the lawsuits were dismissed on legal grounds. The courts didn't feel that you could hold somebody liable, you couldn't hold a manufacturer liable for this kind of thing. Other lawsuits were successful at that stage. Courts started to hold, really for the first time in very groundbreaking rulings, that a manufacturer, if they were negligent in the way that they distributed their product, if they could to do it in safer ways and oversee their dealers and that sort of thing, that that they could be held liable for that. So you started to have some legal recognition of that theory, but in some cases and in some and not in some others. And so sort of the lawsuits were proceeding, and some of them were having some success. In particular, I would say the high point of that litigation came in the spring of 2000, when one manufacturer, Smith & Wesson, you know, a long-time manufacturer of especially of handguns, they agreed to a large settlement with a lot of these cities, and there was a big announcement made at the White House with President Clinton, and the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, Andrew Cuomo, was heavily involved in bringing about the settlement. And Smith & Wesson agreed to do, you know, the guy who ran the company was basically a business guy, not really a gun guy so much, and he basically said, look, all the stuff they're asking us to do, it's not that unreasonable. We could agree to do research on safety mechanisms for guns, and we could agree to oversee our distribution network of dealers better. We can do that. We'll get rid of these lawsuits and get that threat off our backs. And the reaction, however, among gun owners and the NRA was withering. I mean, they just turned on Smith & Wesson and denounced them. They, in part, Smith & Wesson was owned by a British conglomerate at that time, so the argument was that they don't understand the Second Amendment over there in England. And so they really just condemned and started boycotting Smith & Wesson. They were sending tea bags. That's one memorable part of the campaign, to send a message to Smith & Wesson by sending them in the mail lots of tea bags as sort of a reference to the Boston Tea Party and refusing to accept their rejection of the Second Amendment or something, but their business just collapsed, and so they eventually denounced the settlement agreement. And, you know, it looked like that settlement agreement, if it had spread to other companies, it looked like it really would have made a big difference and sort of changed the tide of the issue. But unfortunately, because of the huge backlash against just the one company that had agreed to do it, they almost got put out of business, and they rejected the settlement. So the lawsuits continued for a while, and again, they had mixed legal success, but they definitely had success of drawing attention to the issue, and that was part of the objective. It was to use litigation as a way to underscore the role that the gun manufacturers play in the problem. That it's not that they're one ingredient, obviously not the only one, but they're one ingredient, their practices. And it really did do a good job of shifting the public conversation and the media's attention to that issue. It really exploded. Lots and lots of articles about the gun industry's role in the problem of gun violence. But once Bill Clinton was out of office, and in particular once George W. Bush won the White House in that hotly contested Florida election, yeah, the handwriting was on the wall that things were going to change. Bush was had a lot of support from the gun manufacturers and from the gun owners. In fact, there was a famous clip that made some news during that election. There was a clip of an NRA top official who was caught on film saying that once the election was over, if Bush won, that the NRA would be operating right out of the Oval Office in the White House, and that they essentially would be able to get what they wanted done. And it took them several years. I don't really even know why it took so long. I was surprised that it took so long. But by the year 2005, Congress passed the Protection of Lawful Commerce in Arms Act, and President Bush signed that into law.
I'd like to take a minute to remind our listeners that they're listening to Jaws of Justice Radio on KKFI 90.1 FM. Today we're talking with Alan Rostron, professor of law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, about gun manufacturer liability. We had mentioned briefly the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act. Can you talk a little bit more about that legislation and what it does?
Yes, it essentially gives special immunity to gun manufacturers and to some extent gun dealers from tort law. In other words, normally people have to exercise reasonable care in what they do. If you're negligent, whether it's in driving your car or, you know, dropping something on somebody's foot or running your business or whatever it is, if you're negligent, you can be held liable for it. That's sort of the cornerstone idea of tort law. And the manufacturers got from Congress this statute, which essentially exempts them from that. It basically says that gun companies are not going to be liable for any sort of illegal or other misuse of their product. So if somebody, obviously if a criminal goes out and shoots somebody, that's going to be a misuse of the product. Or even if somebody's being careless with it and accidentally shoots themselves, you can say that's a misuse of the product as well. So more or less, it knocked out all the kinds of lawsuits that were being brought against the gun industry that were attracting all the attention. It has some exceptions in it. So you can still bring, for example, a traditional sort of product defect claim, like if somebody makes a shotgun and the metal in the barrel is too weak, so the barrel bursts and injures somebody, you know, that's a traditional sort of a defect claim that you can still have. And then there are some narrow exceptions under which you can still sue gun dealers. If the gun dealer does something illegal, like if somebody comes in and they say, hey, I'm actually a convicted felon, will you sell me the gun anyway? And so they agree to do that rather than doing the background check. Then that's a crime, and the gun dealer could be held liable for that. But usually it's not that, what gun dealers do is not that blatant. You know, instead it's a situation where they, you know, for example, they'll have two people come in, and one of them clearly is really buying the gun, but he's got somebody with a clean record there pretending to be the purchaser for him. And the dealer will often kind of know that what's up and go along with it. And it can be hard to prove that the dealer knew and therefore that it was a crime. But before the statute was enacted, you could say, well, it's negligent, though. You're not being reasonable, and you're not spotting what's really going on. But after this enactment, that sort of thing, that sort of case is no longer able to be brought, again, unless you can prove criminal activity by the dealer. And so as far as the manufacturers go, they don't engage in criminal activity. I mean, we can argue, and I think that a lot of what their practices aren't as safe as they could be, but they're not criminal because they don't deal directly with the public. It's not like convicted felons go to the factory and purchase their guns at the factory. They buy it from the dealer. So whatever wrongdoing is occurring is at the dealer level, and it enables the manufacturers to sort of say, well, it's not my problem. I'm not there at the dealer level. So again, I'd argue that they could oversee it better, what's going on at the dealer level, but they're able to say, hey, well, I'm not breaking the law, and therefore I'm protected by this special immunity statute. And the statute has been tested in court a few times because, at the time it was enacted in 2005, there were still a fair number of lawsuits going on. There was one in New York City, for example, and they were dismissed, and the courts held that because of the Lawful Commerce and Arms Act that these kinds of lawsuits couldn't be brought anymore. It continues to be challenged, though. There's a case going on up in Alaska where some victims of a shooting are attempting to sue a dealer who was allegedly negligent in the way the gun was sold. And they have some arguments that the dealer actually committed criminal violations, and that would be one way to get around the immunity statute if they can prove that. But the case was thrown out at the trial court level. It was thrown out on the ground that they weren't within the exceptions and that the federal immunity statute protected the dealer from liability. So they're challenging the constitutionality of the Commerce in Arms Act, the immunity statute for the manufacturers. They're challenging it and saying that it's unconstitutional. And it's kind of an interesting argument because it's sort of turning the tables or hoisting someone on their own petard. One of the arguments that is often made from the conservative side of the political spectrum is that we need more states' rights. We need more, state sovereignty and authority and less federal authority. There's been a lot of talk about this in recent years in connection, for example, with the federal health care reform legislation. One of the key complaints about that legislation was, it's taking all this authority from the states that they're supposed to have, and it's over expanding the authority of the federal government to do all these things. And so normally it's the more conservative side of the spectrum who talks about state authority and about the 10th Amendment in particular. The 10th Amendment at the end of the Bill of Rights says essentially that the federal power is going to be limited, that the federal government will have the powers that are listed for it in the Constitution, but nothing else. And so the default rule is that the state governments handle everything. They have a general police power to deal with all kinds of problems, but the federal government only has its enumerated powers. And normally the 10th Amendment is therefore invoked by Tea Party kind of people. They're big fans of the 10th Amendment and like to invoke it and say that it should block all kinds of federal actions. But here, the tables, as I said, are turned, and it's the people attacking this 10th Amendment, this gun immunity statute, who are saying that it violates the 10th Amendment. They're saying, hey, look, all the time the gun industry is always saying, oh, we shouldn't have so much federal regulation and we should have 10th Amendment and federal, the commerce power is being interpreted too broadly and this sort of thing. And here that argument's being flipped against them to say, what authority does Congress have to be regulating tort law and, liability for negligent use of guns all over the country? It's improper.
So it sounds as though the real conflict here is between the 10th Amendment states' rights argument that you laid out and the federal government's ability to regulate interstate commerce. Is that right?
Yes, that's essentially. I mean, to some extent, maybe you could try to justify it on the Second Amendment, too. You could say that somehow Congress has authority to. They threw that in as well when they enacted the immunity statute, tried to base it on the Second Amendment. But it was largely based on the Commerce Clause. As you said, the Congress has the power to regulate interstate commerce. And that is a power that has been generally interpreted fairly broadly. But the question is, does that justify them in passing this law? In other words, the argument for the law, the immunity law, is, well, if you have a bunch of lawsuits against gun manufacturers, that affects commerce. The gun manufacturers are engaged in interstate commerce. And if you are holding them liable for the sale of their products, that's going to hurt their business, essentially, and therefore that has an adverse effect on interstate commerce, and therefore Congress has the power to regulate it. And, again, it puts everyone in the position of arguing what they generally don't argue. People who like gun control, people who tend to be more on the liberal side of the spectrum, when it comes to health care and a lot of other, and civil rights and environmental laws and that sort of thing, they often do have a broad interpretation of the commerce power. So perhaps you could say they're being inconsistent by arguing that the commerce power should be narrow when it comes to firearm issues. However, the other side, if there is an inconsistency there, again, the other side, the more conservative side, is also being inconsistent because they generally are arguing all the time for a narrower view of commerce. But when it comes to guns, of course, then they flip their position and say, oh, no, we got to stick with a broad reading of the commerce power.
So if this Alaska case doesn't gain any traction, I think twice now the Supreme Court has refused to hear arguments on the constitutionality of the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act. If they refuse to hear it, then I suppose the next approach would be to maybe try to repeal this law? Is that an approach that you think would have any traction? Is that a workable approach?
I do think that it should be repealed. Reasonable people can disagree about the extent to which tort liability should be imposed on gun manufacturers. I understand the controversy surrounding that and how you could reasonably argue either side of that. But I never thought it was a great solution to have Congress simply prohibit all the lawsuits, because there are some lawsuits that I think almost anyone would consider valid, where the wrongdoing really or the negligence really is extreme and egregious. And if anybody really looked at it, they would agree, okay, I agree that kind of. So it's sweeping with too broad of a brush to have Congress throwing out all the cases. And I think also it's an issue better left to the courts. Let judges and juries. I have a lot of faith in judges and juries on a lot of things, and I think they could resolve these issues pretty well. So I do think it would be good to get rid of that federal law. There is precedent for getting rid of such a law, but it was at the state level. California had a statute that was passed way back in the 80s that was meant to limit certain kinds of lawsuits being brought against gun manufacturers, but everybody thought it was kind of narrow. And there was a case that came along that went up to the Supreme Court of California about a really terrible shooting at a law firm. A guy had a couple of Tech 9 semi-automatic pistols, and he went in and killed a bunch of people in a law firm in a mass shooting. And it generated this lawsuit. And the manufacturer of the gun was really reprehensible. Just a lot of evidence about they were just really sleazy and said a lot of things about the way they marketed their product really was meant to appeal to people who had bad intentions for the use of the product. So it worked its way up to the Supreme Court of California, and they decided that the statute was prohibited by the state immunity law, that this gun manufacturer had a legislative immunity under California law. And to their credit, the California legislature was so appalled by that ruling that they turned around and they repealed the immunity statute that had been on their books. They took it off, they repealed it, because they said the courts were wrong. It was not meant to protect this. It was not meant to protect a bad manufacturer who's engaged in this kind of clearly negligent, irresponsible conduct. And so they repealed that law, and they replaced it with a provision that simply said that the normal rules of tort law should apply to the gun manufacturers just like they apply to anybody else. And I thought that was a great thing to do, a great law to pass, to say not that we're going to single out gun manufacturers and put special rules on them and hold them liable when nobody else would be, but just that the regular rules apply to them, that if they're negligent, just like any other business, then they can be held liable for it. So there was an example there of that happening in California. Now, it is more difficult to do that at the federal level simply because the country overall is not California. Obviously, California is somewhat to the left side of the political spectrum, and the Congress has a lot of people in it who support the NRA pretty strongly, and both parties. I mean, obviously, the Republican Party is even more identified with the NRA, but a lot of Democrats support gun rights as well and feel that they need that to be on the NRA side of that issue for their political fortunes. And so it is very difficult to get any kind of gun control law through Congress, as people know, and it would be especially difficult to get some kind of law through that would repeal this gun manufacturer immunity. It's just, to the extent, a lot of people don't even know about the issue, so that's probably part of the problem, but to the extent that they do, there's just a lot of people who still, and I think it's just because they don't know that much about what the lawsuits are really about. I think if they were better informed, they would be more sympathetic to them. But they just reject, they don't like lawyers to some extent, and they just don't like the idea of liability. They've been misled by a lot of propaganda about tort reform to believe that all lawsuits are frivolous. And so there's just, among a lot of people in Congress and in the public at large, there's a lot of just instinctual rejection of the idea that gun makers would ever be liable for anything, because they just don't understand what the case is about and what kind of things the manufacturers do. There has been a few articles about it since the recent shootings that have gotten a lot of attention. There's been at least a little bit of discussion of the idea that the immunity law is a bad idea, but it's not an issue that's really getting any traction. And for example, it wasn't included, I don't believe it was mentioned even in all the discussion of what President Obama and the commission run by Joe Biden, the proposals that they put forward, they didn't really touch this. So,
well, we are just about out of time. I want to thank our guest today, Professor Alan Rostron of the University of Missouri, Kansas City School of Law. And thank you to our listeners for tuning in to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM, Kansas City Community Radio. Thanks and have a great day.
there's a story going round about a virus on the town. It can strike it any time or anyone. How your hand goes to your heart when you hear the first report. Somebody snapped, somebody got a gun. In the schoolyard, in the office, in the church, on the train. Here we go again. Interview the neighbors, the lovers, and the friends. The characters keep changing, but the story never ends. Call the doctors, call the priest, call the counselors of grief. Point the camera at the man who wears the frown. For the camera will not tell anything it cannot sell. And the headline is a virus on the town. It's the nature of the beast to prey upon the weak and the diseased. Now there's an odor in the air. You can smell it everywhere. It's the taste of gun smoke on the breeze. And the fingers point to Hollywood. It's a storyteller's crime. All the lobbyists are working overtime for the ammunition makers and the congressmen they buy. They're selling you protection, and the pistols multiply. There's a virus on the land. You can hold it in your hand. You can fill the chamber with another round. You can pull the hammer back and prepare for the attack. There's no safety with a virus on the town.
Just heard Joel Mabus doing his song, Virus on the Town. We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed here are those of the host and guest of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Mid-Coast Radio Project and Corporation, its staff or volunteers. If you have comments or questions, check out the Jaws of Justice radio page on the KKFI website, www.kkfi.org. You can join the Jaws of Justice radio group email. Email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. My name is T. Renee Speaks, and we thank our engineer, Mr. Mike Murphy, host of the Wednesday Morning Buzz. Listen in tomorrow at 9 a.m. for Law and Disorder. Professor Gabriella Coleman of McGill University talks about the ethics and aesthetics of hacking, and Steve Vittoria talks about his film, Long Distance Revolutionary, A Journey with Mamiya Abu-Jamal. Tune in next week for part two on corporate guns with University of Missouri St. Louis professor Kenneth Thomas. Up next, Counterspin, followed at 10 o'clock by Beautician's Blues with Luscious Lynn, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Hogue. Stick around for Jazz and Blues in the Afternoon and Echo Radio KC at 6 p.m.